I've been doing things all wrong.
No, no, I thought it was hilarious.
Oh,
wow.
Call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development to order, March 31st. I'm glad to see we have an enthusiastic and large crowd taking on some important issues today. And start with a public hearing on House Bill 2626. Barbara, if you'd like to get us oriented, please.
HB 2626 requires the state treasurer to solicit investors to finance a new Oregon Department of Energy low-cost loan program to retrofit single and two-family dwellings with energy efficiency upgrades. Modifies the Oregon Department of Energy's small-scale energy loan program, SELP. Increases the state treasurer's and the Department of Energy's expenditure limits for the biennium beginning July 1, 2009, and sets a date for the reports to an interim committee of the Legislative Assembly regarding the funding and implementation of the program. Declares an emergency.
Thank you. You'll remember, colleagues, that this is the bill we've been referring to as EAST. You'll also note that it is responsible for the rather thick amendment that you have in your packets. That replaces the bill. We talked about that during our first informational hearing on it. It is the result of a significant work group effort, and I'd like to start by asking folks who were involved in that process to come talk about that and the amendment that you see before you. So, Angus Duncan, if you would come forward, Lee Beyer, and Jeff Bissonette, three people who were involved in their various roles, and you can talk about those roles in the process that's led us here today. So, whichever would like to start, please.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Lee Beyer, Chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. It's been, one, I want to compliment the sponsors on your concept. I think this is a great idea. From the Commission's perspective, we don't think you can ever go wrong trying to focus on energy efficiency, and I think this is a good effort. Complicated bill. We spent a lot of time. The chairs asked me to work and sort of lead the work group, and I want to give special thanks to Jeff Bissonette and Jeff Keto, who kind of ran the two subgroups on finance and design. A lot of good input from a lot of shareholders in trying to make this a good project. I have to be honest in saying this is hot off the press. I just got it at 11:30 and had not had a chance to turn the page. So I don't know whether we captured everything in the amendments or not, but I know that the chair has asked us to get the work group again together again tomorrow and work on it, and we'll kind of go through it line by line and see what's there and see what changes, at least from the shareholders' perspective, we think need to be there, stakeholders, I should say. So, Mr. Chair, that's my comments. Be happy to answer any questions anybody would have.
Thank you very much. I think that's also a good point you made about the intent today to help us move closer towards the final final product. Speaking only for myself here as one of the sponsors, I think this amendment gets us a lot closer. I recognize that there are probably additional things that need to change, and that's part of the purpose of today to uncover what those things are. Representative Bailey, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, I just wanted to express my gratitude to Chair Beyer and Angus Duncan and to Jeff Bissonette for their role in really negotiating what was a large and sometimes cumbersome process. So thank you for your patience on this, and as Mr. Chair, as one of the fellow chief sponsors of this bill, I see this -1 amendment as the new first draft and additional room for changes.
Thanks. Appreciate the fact that you said that in the past tense. It was a difficult task. Hopefully we're more past than present tense in that respect. Gentlemen, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Angus Duncan. I chair Oregon's Global Warming Commission, and I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, and I'm happy to testify in support of that future final draft of HB 2626 once we get a few additional glitches cleared up, as I'm confident that we will. I've got some written testimony that I'll just summarize if I can.
Please.
First, I would acknowledge that the Global Warming Commission discussed but was unable to consider in any detail this bill, partly because it is a work in progress, was when we took it up and continues to be. So we don't have a position as a commission on this, but it is clearly consistent with our recommendations to the legislature in our report, which you received earlier this month, that we urge upon the legislature the paramount importance of energy efficiency in meeting the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals, strengthening consumer abilities to cope with rising energy costs, and developing business products and workforce skills that will advantage Oregonians in a climate-constrained economy. They would add that this is also clearly consistent with a whole series of recommendations that the state has received from various stakeholder groups and work groups that have worked on global warming and on the state's strategies, and certainly consistent with our history, which has been to focus heavily on energy efficiency as not just a resource, but as the resource of first resort for the better part of the last 25 years, the result being that we have reaped about 3,600 average megawatts of energy efficiency as a Pacific Northwest region. About a third of that is the state of Oregon's share. We've acquired it at an average cost of about 2 cents a kilowatt hour and an average return on investment somewhere north of 50%. So it's been a terrific bargain. That also suggests that there's still additional economic room to acquire additional resource instead of leaving it on the cutting room floor, which frequently our energy efficiency endeavors do. It's a good record, but it falls far short of where we need to be. Despite all of the energy efficiency work we have done over the last 25 years as a state and as a region, our greenhouse gas emissions have risen approximately 1% per year since we started measuring them in the 1990s. There is some indication that we will meet our first greenhouse gas goal, which you adopted in 2007, of flattening that line by 2010 and starting it downward. But even if we do that, it almost immediately turns around and heads back upward unless we continue to apply ourselves and we redouble our efforts. We move from incremental energy efficiency gains to truly transformational energy efficiency gains. And this has the opportunity to achieve those kinds of gains with the key elements of it, the financial platform that allows us to aggregate, you know, long-term patient, at or below market interest financing, the ability for consumers to recover, to repay that on their utility bill, and for one of the few times in the history of energy efficiency to truly give consumers a handhold through the gates and over the fences so that they understand what their choices are with respect to energy measures and with respect to their financing options, including access to federal and state incentives for energy efficiency. You know, it's a hard equation to solve. And this won't solve all of it, certainly, but it takes us a very substantial step further along the way. There are still some additional substantive and language issues that I think have to be worked out, but I'm confident that they can and that you will end up being able to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bissonnette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board and the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition. I will basically echo Chairman Byers' remarks that this has been, you know, a process that has, ignited, incited a lot of interest, and for good reason. I think that, energy issues and reducing our energy usage, finding cleaner ways to generate energy, obviously has a lot of public interest, and so a bill that is fits squarely on that is bound to generate some interest, and it certainly has. I think what this also shows is that we are trying to build off building blocks that are already working pretty well. I mean, through the Small Scale Energy Loan Program, through the Business Energy Tax Credit, through the Public Purpose Funds and the Energy Trust of Oregon, a lot of stuff is working and working well. However, to make a reference to what Mr. Duncan was just talking about, I have a colleague that likes to say we finally figured out how to do 1990-style energy efficiency now that we're in the 21st century. And so I think what this bill is trying to figure out what are the building blocks, what is working, and then build on that and figure out how to do energy efficiency more, different, better, and so that we are reducing our overall energy usage as the cheapest, cleanest source of energy. So I myself, look forward to seeing what is in the bill and getting other people's responses to that. And as Chairman Byers said, do plan on being part of the group that meets tomorrow, and we'll see how close people thought we got and can outline steps to go forward. But have been happy and pleased to be a part of the process, and we'll continue to work hard to make sure that 2626 is a bill that we can all be proud of.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? No questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jeff, would you feel comfortable at all just kind of walking through in a basic sort of sense how the amendments change, just so we can sort of frame up the discussion, and I think you can feel free.
I can, Mr. Chair, I am happy to kind of go through sort of what the intent
That'd be fabulous.
It'll be a little bit from memory, and so if I forget anything to anybody that's important to out there, because again, there was a lot of people around the table, and it'll be because I don't have the notes right in front of me. So
I think that's great, and just a lot of it, I think, for the benefit of the committee, since it's been some time since we heard this bill, to just get ourselves in the right frame of mind as we hear from other folks, that'd be terrific.
Understood. The key agreement that we started to work with is that we needed to test a bunch of stuff to figure out what works. And so we had a pilot approach to testing different financing mechanisms like on-bill financing to any money that is loaned to support energy efficiency projects can be paid back over a long period of time on the utility bill. We wanted to see what kind of outreach efforts helped people get to the point of wanting to do energy efficiency in their homes or businesses. We wanted to test if having loan funds in coordination with existing resources helped. And so I think a lot of the philosophy is we did have a lot to test. We have, and so the intent was to outline a bunch of different things to test through pilot projects. What did work to allow the PUC, in the case of investor-owned utilities, and the local governing boards of consumer-owned utilities to ramp up whatever is working and take it out of the pilot stage and fully implement it, and to what wasn't working, to identify what wasn't working, and if it simply wasn't working because it turned out to be a bad idea, it could sort of be relegated to the recycle bin, or if there was additional authority that was needed that wasn't granted through this bill or that an agency didn't already have, that they could go ahead and come back to the legislature for that additional authority. That is kind of the crux of the implementation side. The financing side is very briefly and probably inadequately summarized as changing some of the authorities within the existing small-scale energy loan program in order to make it more easily available to entities like the Energy Trust of Oregon, like consumer-owned utilities, like other agencies that might take a block chunk of money out of the small-scale energy loan program. So I think that, and then also, too, it was recognizing that both within the CRU territory and within a very small segments of, or very discrete segments of IOU territories, like the service territory of Avista Natural Gas that runs their own energy efficiency programs, like Idaho Power that has a very, very small slice of Oregon service territory, that either, you know, in case of COUs and Avista, we didn't want to upend or disrupt what was already going on. And for Idaho Power, they're commonly kind of taken out of a lot of utility stuff, and we made that same decision here. So I think that hits, you know, the highest of the high points. I'm happy to answer any questions or get down into any details that you particularly want the committee to hear about.
I am very impressed that you did that all from memory. That's very well done. Does that prompt any questions from the committee? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, thanks a lot for all your work on this. Your advocacy around energy issues is really phenomenal in this legislature, I might add. But I'm curious, in the bill, there is some discussion about residential projects and commercial projects. Does this bill envision some sort of, ratio of residential projects versus commercial projects in the use of these loans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, I don't think there's any specific ratio that was talked about. There's a couple different ways that the process envisioned kind of pushing these, you know, potential projects out rather than kind of doing the pull model, which is kind of what we're doing now, which a lot of advertising, a lot of outreach is kind of trying to encourage people to say, oh, I ought to think about doing this, and picking up the phone or logging onto a website to get more information. The big theory behind this is, how do we put this kind of smack dab in front of somebody? And so, you know, whether it's sort of targeting a neighborhood and or, you know, outlining a certain, you know, industry or you know, type of customer that is, you know, in the sort of pilot approach, we're trying to leave some flexibility to do that. And so if, for instance, there's a neighborhood approach, by and large, it's probably going to be hitting residential customers. But there might be some, you know, small commercial, you know, mom-and-pop establishments that we should be, you know, prepared to deal with. Those will be dealt with differently than a residential customer, and that was recognized. And so, again, that's why, in terms of designing the pilots, we wanted the statute to kind of remain silent on that, to be rather permissive, and then we can figure out a lot of the details as we design the pilots and figure out the rules that are needed to implement the pilot projects. So I guess that's a long way of saying there wasn't a particular ratio that was envisioned between residential and commercial.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? And thank you for that. I mean, one of the reasons I bring that up is I'm just wondering whether when you're looking at projects, whether there's a consideration for, I guess, the energy savings that could happen in a particular structure. You know, some commercial structures are very energy inefficient and would bode well to focus on in, you know, the big picture of saving energy. And likewise, older neighborhoods similar to that. So anyway, I was just trying to figure out how the department would, you know, focus where the projects would take place and in what kinds of structures, and whether there was going to be any kind of, you know, consideration of energy savings in deciding what projects get funded and which ones don't.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, that is a good question, because that is the kind of consideration that is actually taken into account every day. For instance, through the Energy Trust will look to see, you know, where the greatest energy savings is. That's how they decide how to spend their money, and which project is going to go without Energy Trust funding or with Energy Trust funding. Where does their money kind of tip the balance in favor of doing the project and thus acquire requiring the savings, where can the most savings be achieved. At the same time, they also have an equity policy for the public purpose funds to make sure that the ratepayers that are paying into those funds, everybody's getting a share of what they're paying into directly into their customer class. And so we did not look at upending that that type of approach, and so we recognize that we want to make sure that we go after projects that have significant savings. And you're right, that will largely be in commercial and particularly larger commercial. But at the same time, one of the things I think we're trying to figure out is going deeper, faster into the residential sector, A, as helpful, and B, does, to a particular household that gets that service, can make both a significant difference on their, electric bill or gas bill, but also just in the comfort of their home and that sort of thing. And so, again, those are things that are considered today, and we expect that consideration to continue under this process.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your flexibility in doing that without a lot of advance notice. Let's hear from Jeff Ketto, Dave Robertson, and Tom O'Connor next, please. I was wondering where you went, Dave. I saw you come in and then they disappeared. Jeff, maybe you'd like to start, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Ketto, Assistant Director at the Oregon Department of Energy, and I manage the Energy Loan Program. A couple of comments that the department is very supportive of the House Bill 2626, the concept, and I think reiterating what the three previous speakers said are just that there is a lot of work being done by the work groups, and I really appreciate all of the stakeholders. They were quite large groups, and I think in most part everybody was pretty orderly and hopefully got their message and their voice heard. I think there's a number of issues that came out of the work groups, and if I can address Representative Holby's earlier question a little bit, we see this bill as the amendment as really an additional tool available within the program, and a couple of the deliverables that have been discussed repeatedly is the delivery mechanism. How do you work with other groups like the Energy Trust? How do you work with the consumer-owned utilities, and how do you deliver? And memorializing within the statute some of those delivery mechanisms, as well as defining some additional payment mechanisms for the ultimate customer through on-bill financing or property tax assessments. And I think what that does is that adds to the ability to help serve what I would call some of the underserved customers out there, which typically have been the residential and some of the small commercial. And the idea is actually to be able to meet the needs of all of the different groups within the abilities of the service delivery mechanism. And the service delivery mechanism will probably be the tool that helps differentiate, or address where those best energy savings are. The program should hopefully have enough financing available to help all the groups. And the finance work group, a couple of the specific issues that were addressed in the finance work group was the concept of the collection. We have not used the collection methodology of on-bill financing before, and how that differentiates from actually the security, how you actually secure loans versus using a utility bill-paying system for collection, making sure that we are, again, making sound loans but have a quick delivery process. I think that's one of the ultimate goals of this legislation, is to have mechanisms that are quick, efficient, as least cost as possible, using stakeholders, including commercial lenders, that will help for the organizations like the Energy Trust to help aggregate some of the individual loans. It'll also give us authority to issue, I'm assuming it will, again, I have not read the 2626-1, but authority to issue revenue bonds. Again, it's an additional alternative to the general obligation bond authority that we presently have. And so I really look forward to working further with the work groups and kind of refining, some of the issues if they weren't properly caught or memorialized in this particular draft, and looking at future drafts to come up with something that will really make a significant difference in our ability to basically help implement more energy efficiency, because like Angus Duncan said earlier, it's definitely the cheapest dollar, is the cheapest energy resource that we have out there. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Mr. O'Connor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tom O'Connor, representing Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association.
And I'm guessing it might be a good idea to pull one of the microphones over a little bit, just for those who might be listening elsewhere. Thanks.
Thank you. So we have participated in all the numerous work group meetings on this bill, and we also held a couple of meetings with Representative Bailey and some of the other folks involved with this, with our local energy conservation managers at our utilities that are running our existing programs, to try to figure out how this might fit into our toolboxes. I want to emphasize that we are in agreement that energy efficiency is an absolute critical tool to dealing with not only with the climate issues, but also with our ability to avoid higher cost power resources. We've been running existing programs through the Bonneville Power Administration and our local utilities in our service territories for well over 20 years now or more. A number of our utilities do operate loan programs in addition to the grant programs we have. Some of them use on-bill financing. Some of them use a local credit union where we buy down the interest rate to zero with a cash investment. Those loan and grant programs are, we try to work with the customer to figure out which is the best one. It's not always a loan program that works best. In some cases, they're better off with a grant program, particularly for low-income folks. Of course, we pay virtually 100% of the cost of the measures. So I guess our interest in this bill is that we've sort of expressed from the beginning is that we're interested in any additional tool that we can bring to help our customers. And I think I'm picking up on what Jeff said. That's the way we hope this bill will turn out. We're looking for something that we could use that, as I say, that would help our customers. We want to make sure, however, that we don't end up with something that comes in, runs over the top of our program, confuses our customers about what's out there, and we end up with a lot of overlap and, frankly, some regulatory authority that we don't think is necessary. So we've been working a lot on this particular bill, and have provided language. We were particularly supportive of the pilot approach to test drive this stuff a little bit and see how it works. I just got the bill over lunch hour and haven't had a chance to look at it. My quick glance at it is that it's because it's an extremely complicated bill, there is, as Representative Bailey said, it's a first draft of, or a first draft of a new version. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in here. We'll be happy to participate in the process. Again, looking at, for something that would be an additional tool that we can use, not something that would run over the top of what we're already doing. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. O'Connor. Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Robertson. I'm here today representing Portland General Electric. We do also have, appreciate the effort that's gone into this bill. It's been work groups back to the summer, I think, and I think it's a very creative way to try to address one pretty important method of reducing greenhouse gases for the utility. This is one of the, I think I completely agree with the chair of the Global Warming Commission, Angus Duncan, when he says this is really some of the low-hanging fruit where we can get the best bang for the buck in terms of carbon reductions for customers. That's a lot better than actually using dollars to shut down existing generating plants when you can pick off these low-hanging fruit beforehand. As far as the bill goes, I've been very supportive of trying to make this work, working through all the working groups. The utilities, Northwest Natural, PGE, and Pacific met prior to the first set of working groups early in the session. I'm not here to speak for them, but I can't say we agree that there are several things we needed to have included in this bill, one of which was the on-bill financing system had to be done correctly. I've got some concerns as I flip through the draft. One of the main issues for us was that we do our on-bill, our billing systems are tied to our customers. So if a customer moves from one part of our service territory to another, we can follow that customer. Right now, the way I think the bill is drafted, it says that the utility must attach it to a meter. That's not going to work for us. We've offered changes in that regard in the work groups. I think we can work through those as we work in the work group again tomorrow and after it subsequently to try to make sure that those changes get in. One of the other things we talked about being very important to us was that the utilities have a role in reaching our customers. I think Tom O'Connor said it just a second ago. Customers want, you know, Fred Meyer approved customers like one-stop shopping. And so we want to make sure that customers aren't confused hearing from a number of voices about various programs. I think in the pilot, we had some language in the draft that talked about public purpose fund administrator working in cooperation with utilities. I don't see that language in here, so I'd like to see that restored when we work through the next work group. Also, the final thing I'd like to mention, there's some concern on our part about carbon credits and carbon reduction credits. We as an entity are going to be held accountable for carbon reductions, either at state or the federal level or both. We want to make sure that if ratepayer dollars or our customers' dollars are used for efficiency projects, that those credits associated with greenhouse gas reductions go to our customers. We're going to have to turn those credits into EPA or whatever agency at the state level that we find is going to be our agencies are going to be our administrators of the greenhouse gas reduction program. So we've had some side meetings. I thought we had some agreements. We'll just need to take a look at the language in here and see how that's working to address that issue. So those are my main issues. Thanks for all the work on this. I know it's a big bill, long draft. We look forward to kind of tearing into it and helping make it better.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And having been involved in some of those conversations, appreciate the way you put that, too, because sometimes it gets lost in translation the way it comes out. So any comments or questions for this panel? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks again to all of you for engaging. I'm just curious, Mr. Robertson, if you could just give us a little bit of context from your perspective about energy efficiency and how that's going to play into your load over the next 5 to 10 years or so.
Sure. I think most, Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I think most members of the committee are aware that we have created, back since 1999, the Energy Trust of Oregon that's on behalf of our customers taken 3% of our gross revenues and invested those in efficiency and renewable energy projects. I do believe that this, we at PG also have an additional tariff on top of that where we add another 1% for energy efficiency to our rates, 1.1%. That was authorized as part of the bill, Senate Bill 838, the Renewable Energy Standard, last year, and that it was designed to capture another 44 average megawatts of efficiency that the Energy Trust helped us identify. And so there are a number of things already going on. We believe this program will allow us to look at, if it's set up correctly, look at efficiency projects holistically. I think that's the intention of it, where you could look at a number of different measures that we could use to gain efficiency. And so any of those types of projects are going to be very helpful to us. There have been a number of studies that have been done, including one by a group called Group McKinsey. I believe they're out of San Francisco, that shows basically where your best bang for the buck is in terms of carbon reductions, and energy efficiency appliance standards are definitely in that category. And it sort of looks at the spectrum of ways to reduce greenhouse gases. So this is one of the places where we believe that you've really hit a chord in terms of not only helping us reduce greenhouse gases, but meeting the energy needs of customers and helping them keep their bills down. So does that help, Representative?
It does. Thank you. It's on a slightly different line. Curious just on the on-bill financing portion, as we're trying to make sure that we're structuring this correctly, do you currently have the ability to do on-bill financing, and what are some of the barriers if you do or do not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, we do have the ability to do on-bill financing as it relates to a loan, because that is tied to the customer. The way we set up this billing system in the early 2000s was set up, set up to help accommodate electric restructuring, and the theory that a number of customers would have different suppliers. And so what we really tried to do is tie this, we call it our customer information system, to the customer. So if you're going to move that away from the customer to a premises or a meter on a premises, that is going to cause us to have to revamp the billing system, and that's going to be at least, we've talked to CUB, and it could be over $1 million just to do that. So what we really want to do is try to keep this with the customer. We believe we can do it now. City of Portland has a pilot program now that's looking at doing a loan program that would be tied to customers. We're talking to them with Northwest Natural and Pacific Core the Energy Trust, and we're trying to work that out, and I believe that we've had some pretty good discussions along those lines. So there's some things we can do now. The meter assessment, however, is not one of them.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair. Sure. And would the pilot phasing project be a method to sort of test some of those different methods of what the best way to do structure that on-bill financing portion? Do you envision testing a few different kinds of methods?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I agree with Tom O'Connor that the pilot approach is a good way to test this stuff out. I believe Jeff Bissonnette said the same thing. So I think we'll be able to take a look at a lot of these pieces. I think you've identified, just in glancing through the bill right here, a number of the categories I think we need to sort of poke around on and see what's really going to work, what's going to benefit customers. And that's really our main objective here. So I think it's going in the right direction for sure.
Thank you.
If I can, I just might add that for a number of our utilities that do operate the on-bill financing or the loan program through the utility, we've had pretty good luck with it. It's pretty straightforward, fairly simple. We do require, however, that if there's a change, if the house is sold, then the bill, the loan is due, comes due, would be paid off with the sale of the house, just like any other loan against property. We also have, as I said, there are a number of consumer-owned utilities who operate these kinds of programs through their local credit unions. And I guess Representative Bailey's heard this before and has worked with us on this, but we want to make sure that we preserve that kind of an option as well, because it particularly for small utilities, to work the loan through a local credit union or a local bank, those are the folks who know how to do this stuff. We can buy it down to where it's a cheaper rate, but they're the ones that are in charge of the loan. It works really well, and we hope that we can keep that kind of an option on the table here, and thank you for working with us on that.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next on our list, Joe Esmond, Brian Krieg, and John Chandler.
you just step down? Can I get Brian?
Oh, sure. That's fine. Sorry, I was looking around. I couldn't quite see him, but there are a number of people I can't quite see.
Big talk.
Pierre.
Come on. Go ahead, John. We'll start one.
Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of House Bill 2626 in the new and improved expanded version. I was very glad that you asked one of the earlier witnesses to summarize the bill, because I would have hated to take a quiz on it, frankly. On a quick glance through, though, it is precisely as it was described, obviously details to follow. And as I told you in the earlier testimony on this bill, when we first started talking over the summer, actually over the last couple of years, in the Energy Efficiency Work Group and other fora with Representative Bailey, before Representative Bailey, with some of the rest of you, about the need to create a better vehicle for energy efficiency, for residential, for commercial, that would create jobs, would reduce carbon, and would create a path that people could actually access without a great deal of out-of-pocket costs to get Oregon businesses back to work and get the houses better heated, more cooled, easier to sell, so on and so forth. And I think we're on the path. It's a good bill. It needs work, obviously. But the idea behind it is this may be the most significant bill to come out of this legislature. I really believe that. In terms of the economy of the state, in terms of moving this energy efficiency and carbon reduction forward in a way that's accessible to broad swaths of the citizenry. It's good.
I'm not sure whether your comment about it being the most significant helps or hurts it, but I appreciate it.
Well, I won't say that the bar isn't set that high yet. I think this is one of the things that we like about the approach that's being taken with this bill, seriously, is that a lot of the conversation about carbon and climate is very ethereal. It's very academic. It's talking in terms that most people can't access because we don't think in that way. This will put it in people's homes. If you start getting people's houses better heated, more efficient, you get their office buildings less expensive to operate, they'll start thinking more about the issue in terms that they can grapple with on a day-to-day basis is a way towards getting people's attitudes to change about energy usage in the country. And it puts people back to work, as I said. Good bill. We'll help you work on it in the future. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Krieg, today representing the Sheet Metal Workers Local 16, the SMACNA contractors, and the contractors of the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association. We were participating in the work group on this and have been active in the bill. We're very supportive of the language as we're seeing it here in the Dash 1 amendment. Of course, haven't read everything yet, but we have reviewed quickly the contractor and worker-oriented language, the training-oriented language, and are very thankful that language is in there, very supportive of that. I guess as we continue to work on this bill, the one concern that we do have is, and it's we're moving forward with this as a policy, is that commercial is included in the actual outcomes of this measure and in a significant way, not just an experimental one or two little projects here or there. This is a significant investment that the state is going to be making. We also have a workforce out there that's very diversified. Yes, there's residential folks who are out of work. We're also looking at workers in the commercial construction side who are starting to lose their jobs rapidly out there also. And so this can be a very powerful tool to help keep some very skilled people back in the workforce. So we would really encourage you to take a look at actually maybe targeting a goal within this because the commercial projects are a little different from the residential-oriented projects. We know that. Our workforces understand that. And we think that there needs to be a little bit of goal setting maybe with that.
Thank you. Mr. Esmond.
Good afternoon. For the record, Joe Esmond, a business agent for the IBW Local 48 in Portland, Oregon. And in interest of full disclosure, I am an active member of the Energy Trust of Oregon as Conservation Advisory Council, which I've been doing for about 7 or 8 years. So I've been following this for years, and I'm very happy to see it. And I've been part of this work group and sort of other work groups over the years, but this is great. We are in favor of this, but I will add some of the things that I heard from Mr. Krieg here. The commercial part is very important because at the Energy Trust, and there's some people in this room who have been on it over the years, they can get the large commercial people, say the office high rises, but it's the small commercial people who don't have the necessary income or the interest to put the up the extra $300 a month for energy efficiency. So if you could, again, like Mr. Krieg said, steer some of this money to the commercial side, I think it'll be very good. And I wish I could top John Chandler, but I can't. So
we all aspire to that.
I,
no, we don't.
Questions for this for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next on our list, Bev Logan, Ben Nelson, and Karen Moyer. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm Bev Logan. I'm a co-chair of the Multnomah County cluster of the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good. MACG is an organization of 29 institutions in the Portland Tri-County area, including mine, which is St. Andrew Catholic Church in the King neighborhood of Northeast Portland. I want to express our support for the general concept of the East Bill. And also express our intention to continue to fight for deeper retrofits and stronger labor standards. We have for years been hearing stories from the people in our institutions about their concern for the environment and the need for more living wage jobs. And in recent years, we've been hearing a lot of stories about families that cannot keep up with the cost of heating their homes. At the same time, our institutions are struggling with rising energy costs. And that has a direct impact on the ability of churches and other nonprofits to provide services to the broader community. So for these reasons, we've been very hopeful about MACG's Sustainable Works Project. It's a model with a triple bottom line of reducing energy costs, reducing carbon emissions, and creating what we call a jobs pipeline for living wage jobs, particularly for underserved communities. I wanted to say that Catholic social teaching has always valued stewardship of the environment as well as the principle of living wage jobs for families and communities, with attention to those who often are treated as the least among us. African American and Latino populations in my church, in my neighborhood, and throughout Oregon have historically been underserved by our economy. We want to see a jobs pipeline that proactively includes various underserved communities, that utilizes certified apprenticeship training, and that this will provide a skilled workforce for the emerging green economy. We also want to see deep retrofits that are necessary to have really substantial reductions in carbon emissions. And at the same time that those are protecting our planet, they'll also create not just jobs, but career pathways for people. So we expect that the stimulus funds that are used in the EASE programs, that they will meet public work standards of prevailing wages, so that responsible contractors that do provide living wages and medical benefits will not be edged out in bidding against contractors who are only paying inadequate wages. It makes no sense to us to have this government program create jobs that at the same time will leave families still needing to depend on other government programs for assistance with health care and other basic needs. And the 180% of minimum wage that's in the language here, we don't think will support a family. And so we are in support of the original language proposed that is 200% of the median wage. So we have an interest in seeing jobs that are created in the new green economy that will actually help create a new, different kind of economy and not just a new color of the same old model. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Ben Nelson. I'm a representative of the Laborers International Union and a leader in the Metropolitan Alliance for a Common Good as well. Our union has several thousand members here in Oregon, and the Alliance has tens of thousands of members and families that we work with in our labor, faith, and community-based backgrounds. I want to expand a little bit on what Bev was saying in terms of interest in the deep retrofits. I understand there's a lot of new material in this bill, basically a new bill that is out in front of you all, and most folks haven't had a chance to look through that. And as this work continues, we want to encourage folks to, in the working group on this committee, to be focused on facilitating as many and as deep a retrofit system as we can as it relates to a couple of different things. First, the climate. When I say deep, you know, we're talking about spending more money per house. I guess it's, you know, bigger loans, more grants. But reducing carbon output from these buildings in the 30 to 50% range, as opposed to some smaller programs or weatherization-type programs that'll be in the 5, 10, 15% reduction range. So we want to encourage that the larger, in terms of the climate, obviously, as one of the first gentlemen said, we're, despite our best efforts, we're still increasing our greenhouse gas emissions every year. So this seems like an opportunity that we need to take advantage of and do everything we can in each one of these structures to make it as efficient so we don't have to go in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years and redo the work, do additional work to try and get ahead of the curve. This seems like an opportunity in this bill to start really moving on the right foot and digging as deep as we can, having as strong an impact as we can on the climate. The second piece for the deep retrofits, in our opinion, has to do with the job creation piece. When you're talking about a deeper retrofit, you're talking about more work, additional skills, more training that's going to potentially create more long-term career path-type jobs. When you look at the smaller pieces of this, there's going to be less skill, less work, and probably a more transient type of workforce. So if we can focus on these deeper retrofits and build that into the bill, I think there's much more opportunity to create real good careers in this this new green economy that that we're working on. So how do we do that? Obviously, it means more money to do the deeper retrofits. And I'm not exactly sure how it's structured, but I guess I would encourage folks to be thinking about creatively about whatever we can do in terms of tax incentives or breaks. These programs we have, increasing low-income grant programs to make it possible for low-income people to do this type of work at their home or their small business. And then, obviously, the as low or zero-interest loans as we can try and structure to make this money accessible to people. I appreciate your time here today, and thank you.
Thanks very much.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Karen Muir, and I am the Executive Director of Phoenix Rising Transitions. We assist people who have been incarcerated with making a successful transition back to the community. I'm also a leader with Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, and we're here to ensure a strong jobs pipeline that's a component of House Bill 2626. Research shows that a primary key to a successful transition to the community and staying out of prison are family wage jobs and benefits with opportunities for advancement. Employment is often denied to ex-felons, and a lot of lists that are about felon-friendly employers are out of date. Jobs that are available typically pay minimum wage and are inadequate for covering even the basic living costs, let alone those costs incurred after prison, which include restitution obligations and fines, back child support payments in various classes, drug tests, and other costs. For MACG, a strong jobs pipeline means a clear point of entry and a pathway for workers to move from pre-apprenticeship to apprenticeship to journeyman status with family wage and benefits throughout the process and those that increase with training and experience. Trade unions do not exclude people who have been incarcerated from participation in apprenticeship programs. Therefore, preference should be given to contractors that utilize apprentices for a minimum of 20% of their workforce. Phoenix leaders have been in conversation with union leaders to make apprenticeships available for those who have graduated from our in-prison leadership training and receive mentoring in the community. Specific projects that retrofit homes and small businesses will create an apprenticeship opportunity beyond anything offered up till now. We hear over and over again that former prisoners want to contribute to the community and work at jobs with potential for advancement. One Phoenix graduate, Kevin, is a journeyman sheet metal worker. He was released from prison a year ago, and the support that his union has given him through a consistent work in Madras has enabled him to stay off drugs and live a responsible life in the community. Kevin's success gives people in prison hope that they too can make it when they get out. But Kevin's story can't be the only exception to this rule. We need a jobs pipeline that makes apprenticeships available for many ex-prisoners as well as women and minorities. These jobs will foster the health and safety of the community as well as benefiting the individuals and families whose lives will be positively impacted by livable wages, health care, and retirement. We urge you to include a strong jobs pipeline as a component of House Bill 2626, and therefore we also respectfully request that you change Section 44, Line 21, to requiring pathways into existing apprenticeship programs rather than merely identifying opportunities for job training and development. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? See none. Thank you very much. Next on our list, Michael Brassell, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Rose Vickery, Nathan Jones. And I hate to say it, as you're sitting down, I'm looking at the clock and another bill that we have yet to hear from as well, so any efforts you can make at being concise would be greatly appreciated.
Yes. Hello, my name is Michael Brassell, and I'm an out-of-work carpenter with Carpenters Local 247, and I have some concerns about this bill, and they really echo the concerns of the woman with Phoenix Transitions, and it's largely the pathways to apprenticeship component. It seems to me that in the amendment here, it really just identifies potential apprenticeship programs, and it doesn't really mandate pathways to meaningful apprenticeships. And I think that another thing that's kind of at issue here is the wage of 180% of the wage as opposed to median income. That puts the wage for this work at something like $15 an hour. If you're installing furnaces as a trained worker for $15 an hour, you're undercutting wages.
I'd just suggest you move the microphone a little bit further away. It won't distort quite as much. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, so I really see that as being an issue. I'd like to see that language be stronger. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Rose Vickery. I currently attend Reed College. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I and Nathan are here as representatives of the Cascade Climate Network. It's a student organization in Oregon and Washington and Pacific Northwest in general that advocates a sustainable, just, and prosperous future for all, particularly in the Pacific Northwest. So we really see that overall the idea of 2626 is really in support of these goals of the CCN. It's a key piece of attaining those goals, I think, in the short term. So we really feel that by creating green jobs in Oregon for all of us, unlike the few short-term jobs that may be created by an LNG pipeline construction, this provides the opportunity for long-term sustainable jobs that benefit everyone in Oregon. And we also see the value in the accessibility of the bill. We would like to see it be a very accessible, broad-based, provide accessible broad-based jobs. Particularly, we'd encourage the inclusion of jobs for people of various incomes, and also the opportunity to access people across the state, not only in cities and in retrofitting homes in cities, but in rural areas and people of various economic levels as well. So we really emphasize we see the broad-basedness of the bill as a key piece of its effectiveness, and we'd really strongly encourage specific language allowing both homes and small businesses to take advantage of HB 2626. We've seen the efficiency as a key piece of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and also the overall sustainability in Oregon personally, as Nathan will tell you about.
Yeah. So as Rose mentioned, I'm a student.
If you can start with your name, that'd be great.
Okay, my name is Nathan Jones. Thank you for allowing me the time to speak to you all. I'm a student at Oregon State University, and I'm here to actually share a story that we've had. We had a recent victory with addressing energy efficiency on our campus. And I'm kind of skipping class today to tell you about it because I figure if we fail at creating a sustainable energy economy, then failing social 424 isn't that big of a deal. But like some of you may have heard, Oregon State has recently received a lot of recognition for being one of the largest purchasers of renewable energy certificates in the country, actually. And we've gained recognition in the Pac-10 for being the top consumer of these credits. Corvallis has been put in, I believe, definitely the top 10, if not the top 5 cities in the country, largely due to the purchase that OSU makes of these renewable energy credits. Although it was really good to begin with, we realized that it didn't address efficiency. And that's why I'm here to support this concept that you all are working out with House Bill 2626. We at first had students voted to charge themselves $8.50 per student per term to go towards purchasing renewable energy credits that would offset our energy use. We didn't, however, factor in the energy efficiency and the increasing cost of energy and the increasing energy use of our campus. And so after only less than 2 years, we are purchasing 70% as opposed to 100% of our energy from renewable sources. This is because we weren't able to factor that in. This year, a group of students that I volunteer with came up with an idea that's very similar to what has been proposed here. It's a sustainable energy revolving loan fund. And what we've done is we've taken a certain percentage of the money that students pay and we put it into a fund that gets loaned out to different business or buildings along campus, and they pay back the loan through their energy savings. Very similar to the concept that you've been proposing. One thing that I wanted to sort of throw out there, Representative Holby, I guess, is left, but he asked a question about, you know, should it be the bigger projects or the smaller ones? And I think that's been something that's come up repeatedly throughout here. Should it be, you know, focusing on large-scale business stuff, or should it be like more small residential things? And what we've learned through looking at multiple different working models of revolving loans that are happening in universities across this country is that it's actually a mixture that works. It's the quick payback on a couple low-hanging fruit, and also the big payback from the big wins that take a little bit longer to implement and get done. So I guess my suggestion would be, in terms of that, is to make sure that it's something that's accessible to both. Make sure that it's something that a low-income family in rural Oregon is able to make the energy efficiency upgrades that they need to make so they can afford their energy bill, but also have it be something that can make the large-scale changes to the larger industries and institutions like OSU, that if we can make them sustainable energy infrastructures, then we're going to make a big, big difference. So I'm just really excited to be here. I've seen in the couple of years that I've been doing this little organizing stuff, I've seen just a groundswell of support from multiple people, from businesses, from politicians, from students, just from community members and family members. And a lot of people, I think, have realized that we're the people that we're waiting for. We're the people that can rise to the occasion and create the solutions that need to be made. And so it really excites me to sit in a room full of people who realize that we are the people who we are waiting for, and that we're no longer waiting, that we're acting. So I just want to thank you, and I look forward to this being a strong and bold bill that will move us forward as leaders both in our states and in our country, and position us to be leaders when we go to Copenhagen for the next climate agreements.
on a national level or international scale as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Thanks particularly for sharing your experience at OSU. Any questions for this panel? Representative Benson?
No, for the gentleman's giving class, which we'll, Rose, we'd skip more of. Just a question. Do you have the numbers for your success there at OSU that you could share with us, kind of showing us how the what actually happened on the ground there? That would be
right.
of great interest.
Well, what we've done this year is we've set up the mechanism to make this happen. So we will have the numbers for you in more like a year or two. The quick payback tends to be about 3 years, where the longer payback projects we're looking at is about 5 to 6. If you want to look for programs that are up and functioning, I would suggest looking at Harvard, where their revolving loan fund brings in more than their endowments, which is huge for Harvard. The president of Harvard recently came out and said that that was their best investment and shifted more money towards it because of its huge return. Another place to look is at McAllister in St. Paul, Minnesota. They've got an excellent working model that we've been sort of modeling ours after as well. And I'd love to send more information your way if you like.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any questions? Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for coming out here today. I don't know what the policy on this is, but I'm sure we could arrange a note or something to your teacher. There's got to be class credit or something that's available for this. But I did want to call out a point that you made that I thought was a very good one. Just to make a comment, Mr. Chair, this idea of the mix of many different kinds of buildings and income levels and paybacks to have the most successful program that comes out of a blend, I think is definitely the intention here, as well as to include institutional buildings as well. So appreciate you coming out here and sharing your experience, and hopefully we can emulate the fine students at Oregon State.
Thank you very much. Next on our list, Ralph Groner, Graham Trainer, and North Cheatham, please. Mr. Cheatham,
you're up.
And as usual, standard disclaimers apply here. We're running out of time, so have another bill. So if you could all be brief, please.
Mr. Chair, usually that's the disclaimers used when I come forward, so I'll do my best.
There's three of you. It applies to everyone.
I've been hitting under a minute in all my hearings this session. Because of this, have to add a minute 30. For the record, Ralph Groner with American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, also speaking in half of my 40 locals, which are called the Green Caucus, which very much so supports House Bill 2626. The financing is unique. It works with existing programs within the Department of Energy. It creates jobs, reduces greenhouse gases. It's viewed with other programs, and this is an energy-efficient Oregon program. So I'll add one new point and leave it at that. One of the things that's happening to the baby boomers, and I looked at this group and realized that I'm speaking to a youthful group. However, there is a problem this bill addresses, and I hope someone more my age group, if anyone's that old in your caucus, will use it on the floor. And that is that we have an outstanding problem facing baby boomers that I hope someone listens, besides those of us working on Measure 50. And that is that fees have taken the place of taxes for retirees. Let me give you a couple examples. Electric rates for a retiree. Sewer rates. We used to get our sewers paid for by the federal government, $3 to one. It's now fees on your sewer bill. Water the same, 3 to 1. Federal match when I was a county commissioner many years ago. Today, zero. You're lucky to get a grant. What does that do to the retiree and the rest of the population? Fees pay for it. Cable fees up. Health care costs up. And one of the things I did that led me to really support this was say, what am I going to do in just a few years I'm retiring? I said, one, I have to pay my credit cards off. Done. Two, I have to pay my mortgage off. Close. But three, I have to reduce my energy cost or I won't make it. So mine's more not only environmental, it's economic. I'm not on PERS, not a public employee. I'm a private employee, and my 401k, as many of you, is in the toilet. So the fact of the matter is I have to look at how I can reduce my cost. You are helping me because I went to the Energy Trust of Oregon and did what you're doing here, and I didn't get to finance it this way. I had a new energy-efficient furnace, insulation, windows, and the whole kabaz. My home now, my heat bill per month and my electric bill have been cut in half. And that was one of the economic reasons I did it. And so what I'm saying to you, with the energy cut, with the cost of fees skyrocketing, hitting people who will be going on Social Security and more limited SEP IRAs and 401, they absolutely, in conjunction with Senate Bill 79, the energy efficiency rating measure coming up in the Senate, frankly offers retirees an opportunity to reduce their costs because they're going to need every method they can, because every other rate is escalating on them at an astounding rate, and by the way, rather frightening in this state. So wholeheartedly support this, but not only as a member of AFSCME and DEQ and all the environmental agencies and the Green Caucus, but also on behalf of the future retirees and existing retirees.
3.5 minutes. Not bad, Ralph.
Thank you.
Mr. Cheatham.
Chair Reed and the committee, thank you very much for tolerating my presence here today. I've been here before, and I would very much like to support this bill, and I'll tell you why. I have to talk somewhat conceptually on this, because, as you know, there's been some amendments to this bill. There's also the question of how this relates to other bills circulating around here, like 2181, the local improvement districts bill, and I'm not sure if Senate Bill 201 is relevant here. It may be dead by now. I don't know. But there's a number of things that I'm going to have to talk conceptually about this. First of all, did I mention my name, North Cheatham? Okay, I'm sorry. North Cheatham, and my background is I am a public interest lobbyist. I speak on things that I feel affect the most people and in the most cost-effective way. And I am assuming, for the sake of public interest, that greenhouse gas reduction is important, energy cost containment is important, to do this in the least cost manner is one of our priorities here. The reason this is a fantastically important bill, right up there with carbon cap and trade, is because it would result in a massive build-out of the cheapest energy to those who need it most. There are many people out there that are simply unable to take the financial steps necessary to realize the cost savings that would result in a more efficient residence. These people are more looking at how to pay their mortgage off, how to pay for food, how to pay for medicine, and energy gets the short shift. This loan program would result in the cheapest energy to those who need it the most. And this is all about savings. We're talking about savings, the avoided cost of new power plants. We're talking about making 25% of our power renewable by 2025, a realistic goal. And we're talking about saving homeowners money. We've made a lot of progress in terms of what we've done to date. Since 1975, we are using now 48% less total energy per dollar of GDP generated. We're using 54% less oil per dollar of GDP generated, 64% less natural gas, and 66% less water. There is a tremendous amount of potential to continue this path we are doing now because of the technological innovations that have been coming along steadily and, in fact, increasingly, as well as programs like this one that would have the highest benefit to cost ratio implemented right into the wording. This would do wonders for our housing industry. A lot of these guys are hurting bad. We heard from a gentleman earlier today from the home building industry, and we see it every day. This would put a lot of people back to work. This bill, as written, performance would be monitored, energy savings would be verified, and the really great thing about this is the money in the energy efficiency and productivity fund would be continuously recycled and reused for new projects as the program continues. In closing, I will just remind you that the cheapest kilowatt is the one that is not used.
Thank you very much. Mr. Traynor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Graham Traynor, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. I want to thank you for the opportunity. I'll keep it extremely brief, but I did want to thank the sponsors of the bill, and we greatly appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this discussion. And we feel very pleased about the input that was taken, through the work groups that we were a part of. Going into this, the work group process, we felt that there was a very significant opportunity with the EE's concept. About a month ago, I testified in support of the concept and laid out a few concerns, and I'm going to speak specifically just to the economics of this. We felt at the time, and still do, that that quality and contractor job quality and contractor standards needs to be addressed in any taxpayer subsidized program, and so through the work group we were able to submit language regarding those two areas. So I'm going to again just thank folks for the opportunity to be involved, thank them for the input that we were able to insert into the conversation, and specifically in section 14 around the contractor certification. We addressed wage standards, license bonded insured requirements, a proven track record in these types of projects, energy efficiency and home weatherization. Feel strongly about the equal opportunity employer piece, any compliance with state safety, health, wage, hour requirements, hiring from the local workforce, prevailing wage for commercial. We feel good about where this has come. The other piece that we did submit input on was section 44, which is a job training piece, and in statute we feel strongly about laying out who should be at the table if and when any job training comes out of the program. And so by making sure that the state workforce programs, organized labor, state apprenticeship and training council, BOLI, and consumer advocacy proponents are at that table. And again, we just want to make sure that that quality work is done by quality contractors. And so the two areas that I would like to see us address in future amendments as we move this process forward will be in section 15 sub 3 regarding health benefits, that contractors who are awarded work are not just can or may offer health benefits to their employees, but they shall. So we feel strongly about the shall language there. We feel that in order to use this as an economic development tool as well as reducing carbon emissions, we feel that we need to not only address wage and hour or wage standards, but also the benefit piece. And the second piece, I'll just echo two previous testimonies. Regarding commercial targeting, we feel that it's important that we do target in statute a chunk of the financing available through this program to go towards commercial projects. And with that, I will conclude my testimony and answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Graham, I appreciate your testimony on this twice now, and you've mentioned apprenticeship a couple times, and I'm just sort of reading into your testimony from today and before. Is it the AFL-CIO's position to support apprenticeship requirements on public projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, the Oregon AFL-CIO is interested in seeing existing apprenticeship programs utilized and not fly-by-night programs implemented, because of the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Sorry for the
answer. Thank you all very much. Next on our list, Jeremy Page, Stephen Kafouri, and Jeremy Anderson, please.
working hard to conclude quickly. We have one more person after your panel, and we have another bill that I'd like to be able to hear at least briefly. So as quickly as you can go, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Gaffori. I'm here today representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. We're the folks that actually do the work. We have members who specialize in weatherization. We also have people who do this as part of their other business. We as an organization are very much interested and we're very supportive. However, as the people who are going to be doing the work, we felt that we've kind of been left out of the game so far. There have been a lot of work groups talking about administration and finance, but nobody talking about who's going to be actually pounding the nails and putting the sheetrock in. I have a couple of people who here talking about some of the problems that are in the bill. I'm glad to hear that it's a work in progress, Mr. Chair, and we would like to be involved as the bill goes forward in helping this be a bill that can be working in the real world. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, well, my name is Jerry Page. I have a weatherization company here in Salem called Total Comfort. I've been doing this over 35 years. I recognize that there's very many pieces to this puzzle, and the piece that I represent is sitting across from the homeowner explaining these programs and trying people to actually purchase or acquire the energy that we're doing. It's very reminiscent of House Bill 2246 back in the early 80s. That's when Senator Wayne Fawbush, or Representative Fawbush, sat in your chair, Ten Halleck on the Senate, Gene Modlin was the sole PUC commissioner then. And the piece that was overlooked then and is being overlooked now is the contractors. And the language is so, so important, the details. The devil is in the details. And House Bill 2246 enabled the utilities to kind of get in the weatherization business. But in that language were wording, structure, however you want to term it, that caused huge delays. And I'm fearful that there's some of this in here. So when this committees were first formed, we were assured that contractors would be a piece of it, that we'd be part of that committee. We have not yet. So my plea is we need to be involved. You need to listen to us. It took three legislative sessions to fix what should have been done the first session back in the 80s. And personally, I don't want to spend six more years going through that process again. So we support, you know, the efforts, but the devil's in the details, and we really need to be addressing those details.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Anderson. I'm here representing WISE, or Trade Association of Weatherization Contractors. I'm also speaking on behalf of Buck Shepard, who is the president of ORACA. So that would be the residential air conditioning and furnace contractors. I think I'm going to echo the theme of the day, which is we're very supportive of the idea and of the bill. However, there are certainly some details to be worked out still, specifically regarding the audit process and regarding some of the wage and benefit issues, which would increase cost to the homeowner and therefore inhibit conservation. So, in the interest of time, we'd very much like to be included in moving forward with some future amendments to clean up a few details.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Glad you're here. I don't think to date there has been anyone excluded from any work groups, so I appreciate your willingness to be part of it going forward. Last person on our list is Todd Wynn.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Wynn. I am the climate change and energy policy analyst and economist with Cascade Policy Institute. I'm going to keep this really, really brief because I didn't happen to get the amendments on this. So if my statements happen to be not applicable to the changes in the HB 2626, then you can disregard it and only waste 30 seconds of your time. So I agree with this bill. I think it seems like a good idea to find other options to pursue energy efficiency. The part I'm concerned with is the energy efficiency or energy savings fee that's in Section 4 of the original bill. And the thing that concerns me is that if a homeowner decides on a cost-effective upgrade that actually ends up saving them money, the fee would take away a lot of the incentives to even pursue that upgrade. And then second of all, in that actual bill, it actually states that the fee can be used to enable homeowners to purchase energy efficiency features or packages that would otherwise not produce sufficient energy savings to offset the cost to homeowners. So in fact, you're reducing the incentives to pursue energy efficiency, cost-effective and legitimate energy efficiency upgrades. upgrades, and you're giving money to projects that actually waste time and resources. So it just doesn't seem to make much sense to me. Thanks.
Thanks for your testimony. Representative Bailey?
Point of clarification. I appreciate your testimony. Mr. Wynn, were you're referring to the original House Bill 26? Okay.
Yeah. Did it happen to change? Energy's savings fees out.
I think there's a pretty significant set of pages, so you might want to check out the amendments. All right. More than 40 pages of them.
Yeah, I know. Thank you.
60. Thank you very much. With that, that completes our list of testimony. Folks who want to testify on 2626, unless there's anyone else who'd like to say anything. I don't see any objections, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2626 and open a work session on House Bill 2626. Committee would be very interested in just adopting the -1 amendments. We don't plan to go any further than that today, but that would help us as we continue to refine and narrow in on what we hope is going to be the final product very soon. Is there any discussion generally in the work session? Seeing none, Representative LeVue.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the -1 amendment on House Bill 2626.
Thank you. Representative Galizio moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2626 dated March 31st, 2009. Is there any discussion? Representative Benson.
Only to mention, Mr. Chair, of course, a vote on this would not necessarily require a similar vote later.
Absolutely. Thank you for making the clarification. Okay. Representative Gillen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly to say, I too am gladly voting for this with that reservation, but also with the clarification that I really appreciate your work and Representative Bailey's work. This is not easy. I believe it's very important, and I appreciate the hard work. It's a big bill, but it's a big deal. Thanks.
Thank you for the kind words.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting the -1 amendments? Seeing none, the motion carries. -1 amendments are adopted. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2626 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3039. Barbara.
HB 3039 requires the Public Utility Commission to undertake a study of qualifying renewable energy projects and report their findings to the 76th Legislative Assembly. Repeals the Act on January 2, 2012.
Thank you very much. We have a number of people who have signed up to testify, and in the interest of time, I think I'll call up people all together. So Desiree Strader, Bob Beisner, and Dave Antoff. If you're all here, please. Scared everyone off,
Ezra? I did. I have that ability.
Well, you can get started and call the others up as they appear.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Desiree Strader. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. We are the leading voice of the solar industry in the state of Oregon. OSEA's membership base includes installers to manufacturers, vendors, suppliers, utilities, labor, and the Oregon University System. Oregon is now leading the nation in the development of solar manufacturing jobs and has become a force in driving progressive public policy throughout the nation. The Oregon Solar Initiative, House Bill 3039, is an aggressive piece of legislation that will add another tool in this state's renewable energy toolbox. The Oregon legislature over the last several sessions, under the leadership of Governor Kulongowski and the Public Utility Commission, has supported public policy initiatives that have laid the foundation for this bill. One could say that you have let the solar genie out of the bottle, and now it's time to put its magic to work. House Bill 3039 was built on the work laid by the Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group and was carefully developed with stakeholders ranging from energy efficiency experts, global solar industry leaders, utilities, and the Public Utilities Commission. This bill crafts a public policy framework for deployment of solar technologies in Oregon and would be the first of its kind in the nation. House Bill 3039 has three parts. First, establishing a bottom, not a ceiling, on a 250-megawatt goal by 2020. What this does is establish Oregon's first solar feed-in tariff pilot, which will test the marketplace to uncover better ways of integrating solar power into Oregon's electric utility grid. This bill will encourage but not mandate utilities to investigate and invest in large-scale solar projects. It will also create a capacity goal to drive the state to meeting a 250-megawatt goal by 2020. The second thing this bill does is a pilot project, a 25-megawatt annually, not to exceed 50 megawatts by 2015. The main purpose behind this policy is for the Public Utility Commission to give direction to the utilities to explore the use of solar technologies in building out our state's utility grid. Currently, our existing utility regulatory framework does not encourage utilities to pursue research and development of new technologies like solar energy and generation. This pilot project will encourage utilities to invest in large-scale solar and describes the exemptions to procurement regulations. And last but not least, it provides a 3-to-1 multiplier for solar within the Renewable Portfolio Standards, known as the RPS. We propose a modest preference for solar, a policy decision to establish support for the development of solar technology and the industry within the state of Oregon. We believe this is critical in leveling the playing field within the renewable category while minimizing the hit to ratepayers for investing in solar. We acknowledge that this is a modest preference for solar, and as the legislative body, it is within your decision-making powers to establish it into the state law for Oregon. We believe we have developed an elegant solution for minimizing the cost of this preference by allowing solar to generate a 3-to-1 credit under the Oregon RPS. What this should do is reduce the cost of complying with Oregon's RPS for Oregon ratepayers. The remaining language of this bill clarifies and defines the roles of the utilities, developers, manufacturers, customers, and ratepayers in one bill. We felt it was critical and necessary to include these definitions to make it crystal clear the effects of the legislation and how it would have on each partner and how they all play a vital role in making solar energy a reality in the state of Oregon. In closing, we have an amazing opportunity in front of us with House Bill 3039. Upon a recent trip that I took to Washington, D.C. to meet with key staff of President Obama's administration, including the Council on Environmental Quality, Oregon was praised over and over for leading the nation in deployment of solar energy. With the President's charging forward with his commitment to building the solar highway, the Oregon delegation leading the support of the ITC and other renewable energy tools, we are being called upon to share our knowledge and our expertise in making this a reality. The Oregon Solar Initiative has the potential to be a template for a national feed-in tariff. I encourage us to continue our leadership, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Mr. Bison, anything to add?
Chairman Reed, Representative Iglesias. Thank you very much to the members of the committee for allowing me to speak. I'm Bob Beisner. I'm a vice president with SolarWorld. We're in Hillsboro, Oregon. We're also part of an international company, SolarWorld AG. And I'd like to speak about the successes that similar programs have had in Germany, in Japan. These are probably the two stellar examples of how these types of programs have driven an industry. They have created jobs, they have reduced carbon emissions, and they work a long way towards providing energy security, which is so vital for every nation. The things that happen are job creation. In Germany, this type of program has created 42,000 jobs, and we now have over 80 manufacturers producing solar cells, solar components in Germany. The national organization in the United States feels that this type of program could create between 55 and 60,000 jobs in the United States. These are the types of things that we need now. We should also talk about the way this could tie in with some of the stimulus money that may be available, such as energy credits, credits that could be given to help relieve some of the pressures up on the various states. And it would also level the playing field for the various states. So with this bill, we have the opportunity to show Oregon as a true leader and as a state that will be able to show the nation which way to go on green energy. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It occurs to me that I erred a little bit in not clarifying that what we're actually talking about now is the proposed Dash 1 amendments to 3039. We're moving through a lot of amendments, so I forgot to mention that. So are there any questions for these two, and then we can hear from Mr. Bantov. Representative Galizio.
Thank you. I had a question for Ms. Strader, Commissioner Strader. Could you say how a 3-to-1 multiplier qualifies as a modest?
Yes. A couple things. One of the things that other states have done is really produced a solar carve-out, or as we like to say, a REC multiplier. And to address the cost differentiation between wind, for example, and solar, because what you often hear is that solar is too expensive. So what this does is it brings it down to a level playing field. And that's what we mean by modest, is that gap in cost. And there's a couple reasons why you want to do that. First, you want to diversify your renewable fuel types as a state. Number two, you want to diversify your technology types. And last but not least, you want to differentiate between the various project sizes, whether it's in land mass or location or megawatt. And that's what a 3-to-1 does in this case.
Questions, Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on that question, what's the increase in cost for the ratepayers? Do you have some sort of numbers for us that could kind of show us what we should be telling the ratepaying public this is going to cost them?
No, we don't, because that's not up to us in this bill to determine the increase in rate costs. It will come up from the PUC, and they will determine during a rate case what that cost would look like.
Why don't you get follow-up, please? For us to think this through carefully, we'd need some sort of an indication. So you must have some idea of what a ratepayer would be facing in the event that this bill passed. I don't need a specific number, maybe a percentage.
Or perhaps you could draw on some of the other experiences you've talked about in other states and so on.
You want to
take this one? I'd be happy to. There's, of course, the fact that the way that the bill is currently written, that these would come from the public service charges. So there shouldn't be an exact increase for any of the ratepayers. The situation that exists in Germany and Japan, it's about 2 times the regular rate that has been required of the utility payer for these types of feed-in tariffs in those 2 countries.
The reason I was a little elusive is the fact that on the 25 megawatt, it's next to nil. It's fairly invisible. It would be very limited. But even at the bigger scale, we're still talking less than probably 1%.
Sure. Less, you'll have to forgive me, but I don't know the area very well, so I need to know less than 1% of what?
Increase to a ratepayer. Wasn't that the question, is what would be the increase to the ratepayer?
Yes.
Yes.
Following, sure. So if we were to adopt this, and if we were going to have some sort of positive participation, what would you suggest would be positive if you're looking at this type of encouragement to the utilities? What type of participation are we looking at? You said a 25 megawatt. Are you looking at dozens of those or one? What kind of...
The pilot project is... The 25 megawatt is specific to the pilot project. The overall feed-in tariff is up to 250 megawatt by 2020.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, so if we were successful in reaching that goal, what kind of... You're thinking that it would be 1% increase in all of the ratepayers' monthly bills is what we could anticipate if we were to reach that kind of goal? Is that what I'm hearing?
Are you saying 1% monthly or 1% overall annually?
Like annually.
I think that's
yes.
Annually. Yes. So we, by simply increasing the cost to the ratepayers by 1% annually, we could get to 200 and how many megawatts?
250 megawatt. It's a bottom, not a ceiling, by 2020.
And so that's what would be the ceiling? What would be your hope that would happen if these incentives are so attractive we actually achieve success in your mind? What are we looking at?
Currently, right now, solar is less than half a percent. So what I would consider to be successful is that by the end of 2020 that we see not only grid parity for solar, but that, you know, it's 10, 15, 20% of the state's energy generation.
Follow up. And am I correct in hearing that we can do this by only raising ratepayers' costs by 1% a year? Is that what I'm hearing?
I can't make a hard line that I can guarantee you that because we have to go through a process. This is a foundation and template, and based on the numbers we used, we're talking, they're very minuscule. I'm just saying 1%. I looked over at Dave and I said, you know, 3 to 4%, it's much lower than that. But I, you know, we got a lot of green to cover in this bill before we can say, hard fact, it's less than 1%.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Real quick, I'm thinking you might be able to tell me. I'm trying to visualize if we did a 250 megawatt system, and I know this wouldn't be the case, but if we put it all in one place, how much space are we talking? I'm trying to visualize the size.
How many square miles would that?
Whatever it is. Yeah, but let me know. I'm just trying to figure out what you're talking about.
Probably what I need to do is get back with you on the exact size. So
okay.
I'd be happy.
Maybe a follow-up. What would be a typical size project for, say, a residential project?
A residential project will put about 20 panels on a rooftop.
Okay, and that equals?
That would be four kilowatts.
4 kilowatts. Mm-hmm. And we're talking megawatts here.
Yeah, 4,000 okay. kilowatts. So that project is almost 1,000 times greater.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. I guess we'll go on to Mr. Vantoff then. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the chance to testify. My name is Dave Vantoff from the governor's office for the record. And we just wanted to highlight that one of the governor's goals of session was to develop a pilot program that would test out this feed-in tariff or production payment incentive concept to give us some sense of how that worked in the marketplace in Oregon compared to our existing tax credit model for developing these systems. We're very encouraged that OSEA has worked very hard to try and put some substance into the concept. What the governor proposed was largely having the PUC develop a pilot project around this and let them work on what the details would be. The bill that's before you gives some detail as to how that pilot project would work, and we're supportive of legislation going forward that will move this pilot into being in the state of Oregon. So we're very encouraged with that. In terms of the broader elements of the bill, we're also interested and encouraged by trying to move the solar industry forward in Oregon. We're still working through the bill, but most of the pieces of the broader discussion looked good to us. One area that we do have concern with is the 3-to-1 provision in Section 12. We're still looking at that, but we're a bit concerned about how that would affect the existing RPS structure, and we're trying to make sure that we're not eroding the effort that is called for under the existing RPS. So that's one area that we've got a little concern with and are looking at. But overall, we're hopeful that this committee is going to move forward with significant solar legislation and something that's going to advance that pilot project.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Vantoff? Thank you very much. I realize I owe an apology to Mr. Beyer, Mr. Chair. There's another sheet of folks who are testifying, and I lost the sheet momentarily, so I would have called you up earlier, but would love for you to come up now and help us understand your perspective. And if Jeff Bissonnette is still here, you were also on that other sheet that I lost. So if you gentlemen would like to come up, please. I see you brought another Lee with you, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, again, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm the chair of the Public Utility Commission, and I've brought with me Lee Sparling. Dr. Sparling is our director of utility services, so if you have any really hard questions, he gets to answer them. Mr. Chair, the PUC has been in the forefront of advocating renewables and diversifying our mix, service mix, for years. So we find ourselves in the odd position today of being in opposition to the Dash 1 amendments to the House Bill 3039. The Commission, however, does support a pilot project to test European-style feed-in tariff for solar voltaic projects. For those who are not familiar, under a feed-in tariff, a customer's utility buys the output of a solar PV project at a rate that's high enough to make the project economic. In other words, you figure out what the real costs are, and then you add to that to make it economical for the PV owner to make the project work. That's essentially the notion behind those. House Bill 2121, also before this committee, was introduced to authorize a feed-in tariff pilot to help the Commission and U.S. policymakers better understand both the benefits of having solar PV as part of the electricity system and what amount of subsidy is necessary to bring PVs into that system. The Commission has developed an amendment to 2121 to help specify how that project would work, and we would have that at hopefully at some point in front of you. However, the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3039 sets a hard target of 250 megawatts for solar PV development in the territories of the three investor-owned utilities in the state, and those are Portland General, PacifiCorp, and Idaho Power. The reason for the Commission's opposition is simple. Based on what we know today, solar PV appears to be the most expensive way to meet the Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standards and reduce greenhouse gases. And the reason the Commission has a concern is your mandate to us is to get the least cost energy possible for these customers that also meets your environmental constraints. In this case, we're talking about the Renewable Portfolio Standard. So there are two illustrations that I'd share with you about the cost of solar PV. First, the Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group over the interim, in working with this, figured that a feed-in tariff would have to pay 35 to 40 cents per kilowatt hour to make PV projects economic. By comparison, Portland General's average residential rate currently is 10 cents a kilowatt hour. In addition, our rough estimate of the value of the energy generated in terms of savings and other utility costs and the value of renewable certificates would bring that up to about 15 cents. So you're seeing the difference between 15 and 35 or 40 is what we'd be talking about in a subsidy that would be needed. Another way to look at the solar PV costs is even with the subsidy that's currently being provided by the state and federal tax credits and incentive payments that are available from the Energy Trust, which roughly meet 75% of the cost of a residential PV system, the payback of the remaining balance at today's rates would cost about or take about 24 years. Now, we realize that the cost of photovoltaic systems is coming down. However, in view of the current level of subsidization needed, the Commission believes it's not appropriate to set a hard target for a large amount of solar PVs at this time. PG&E and PacifiCorp are already subject to the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and they are required to submit resource plans that identify how to meet the RPS at the lowest cost for their customers. Setting specific targets for the solar PV would open the door to carving out portions of the RPS requirements for other renewable resources, such as are we looking at setting specific targets for biomass, for wave, and for any other thing there. So it makes it more complicated to operate the RPS and receive your climate goals the more requirements or sub-requirements we put in there. And I would point out that specifically the 3-to-1 requirement, what you would actually be saying is that at 3-to-1, overall you would be getting less climate or carbon capture with that because you're essentially giving away two of those, if you will, think of it in terms of credits. The Commission has three other concerns about the proposed Dash 1 amendment. The first deals with the cost recovery for utilities. While utilities should have an opportunity to recover reasonable costs for meeting any statutory requirements for the development of solar PV, the amendment goes overboard in guaranteeing cost recovery and limiting the Commission's ability to determine whether the company acted prudently. For example, it would prevent the commission from requiring a utility to use competitive bidding to find the best large-scale solar PV project. The amendment also undermines the commission's process for determining Oregon's fair share of the cost of a multi-state system such as Pacific Core by requiring Oregon customers to pick up any of the cost of meeting the solar PV standard that other states don't want to pay. I should explain that under our current system, Pacific is a six-state system. We have what we call a multi-state process that allocates the cost among the states in proportion to their shares. What this would do is say all of the costs of this thing would be borne only by Oregon customers, and that's different than the way we're dealing with wind or other technologies now. Second, the Dash 1 Amendment expands the impact of net metering by allowing solar PV generation at one location to be used to offset usage and bills at another. This application should not be adopted without further study. Finally, the language in the Dash 1 Amendment is unclear in many regards. It would greatly benefit from a technical review by a stakeholder group, much as we were talking about in the previous bill. For all of these reasons, the Commission opposes the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 3039. The Commission recommends that the committee defer action on the amendment and consider the pilot approach that the Commission is proposing in House Bill 2121, which was the governor's part of the governor's package. So, again, I want to close and say we are not opposed to solar in general. We think this bill does a little bit of putting the cart ahead of the horse. We need to study it. You need better information about the cost so that you know exactly how much subsidy is necessary for this technology to work.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And I'm actually really nervous about the time, given that the next committee is starting to gather. They have a large crowd gathering. So what I'd like to do is carry over the hearing until our next meeting. But before we do that, I'm looking through the list of people who have signed up to testify. I see one person that may have a little more difficulty getting back here on Thursday than others. Ms. Barnes, are you available on Thursday, or would you like to take about 60 seconds?
I would very much appreciate it.
Please. Is that okay with you, sir? Okay. We have a very short bit of time, Ms. Barnes, just because the next committee is gathering, and I can say with confidence now that this is not the end of the discussion. So
thank you.
I'll
do my best to limit you. No, however close I can be. I would like to just say that we also have concerns about the amendments to HB 3039, but I do want to begin by saying we applaud the authors of this bill for taking the initiative to move forward with feed-in tariffs. Feed-in tariffs is a model that has proven very successful in other countries in both expanding the amount of renewable energy and creating hundreds of thousands of jobs. So we know, we really believe it's time we move in this direction. We're concerned that we apply the model in a way that produces... I'm sorry, am I not being able to be heard?
No, I was going to ask you to just state your name for the record, please.
My name is Judy Barnes, and I represent the our citizens' organization, Oregonians for Renewable Energy Payments.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. Anyway, we are concerned that there are different ways to apply the feed-in tariff model, and in each way you apply the model, you produce different results. And as a citizens' organization, we would very much like to see the application of the model, which brings to us very many of the same results that we're seeing in Germany and now Spain, France, Denmark, and 46 other countries, including the UK, has now decided to go this route after trying other approaches. And I would like to just share with you some examples of what we're talking about. This is a picture of a Gothic church in Germany with solar panels on its roof. It's an example of something we might be able to see here. Another one, and here we see an example of a rooftop solar on a housing division. We have already talked with members of the faith community, and you will be getting... Yes, okay, thank you. And we will be sharing, they will be sharing with you at a future date.
Thank you.
Many of the members of the committee know, there is another alternative that Kennedy will be looking at, and that is HB 3038. While we support the intent of this bill, we are very concerned that its residential component is not strong enough to produce the results, and the results I'm talking about in the community are local economic development. For 35 years, I'm old enough to remember the oil line, the lines of the gas station, the OPEC oil crisis. For 35 years, I've been waiting to see solar sprout on my neighbor's roof.
Thank
hasn't happened yet.
Is
that all?
Yes, I really have to cut it off.
Thank you. The residential component, please look at it closely.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And you could be absolutely as quick as you possibly could. The Land Use Committee is eagerly awaiting their chance.
Okay. My name is Frank Viola. I'm director of the University of Oregon Solar Radiation Monitoring Lab. I want to set some of the background for this legislation. I won't be able to make it up on Thursday.
It looks like you're also submitting written testimony. Is that right? So we will read that. If you could just very quickly summarize,
all
we'll continue
I'm
the conversation on Thursday.
Oregon has abundant solar resources. It's six times the amount of electricity that can produce that's used in the region. Now, if you look at the map of that's in the testimony, you can see that Oregon has, two-thirds of Oregon has as much solar resource as Florida. And so the resource is definitely there, and even Astoria has better than resource than the best areas in Germany. Now, for an optimum energy mix, you really need to have all the resources. On the other side is a map of the solar resources in the Northwest here, and you can see that in the summer we get most of our solar resource and in the winter we don't. Well, other resources such as wind, hydro, and wave tend to peak in the winter, and what you need is a balanced resource portfolio, and so solar complements the other resources. So if you are going to develop solar, you're going to need to have solar in there for the overall energy mix. And I think that some of these goals, especially the pilot program, are great, and I'll let you read the rest of the
time. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. I apologize for having to hurry through it.
Yeah.
With that, unless there are any other comments for the good of the
Chair, Herb, why don't I feel like Florida?
Good question. Well, then we'll take that up on Thursday. So we'll carry this this public hearing over till Thursday. Have we given the notice that we need to in order to do that? Very good. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3039. Thank you. Thank everyone for their patience, particularly on the Land Use Committee and adjourned committee. Thanks.